But I got the real prize, domestic bliss. Jan made me breakfast this morning. Well, she bought the milk. It's soy.
This is why I do it. That's what I have to come home to. She probably won't be up for a few hours.
Gotham Sports Network presents NYG Weekly.
Welcome to another episode of NYG Weekly. This is Will filling in for Ethan with Weiss. Before we get into everything, we got to take care of the housekeeping. Follow us on Twitter, Ethan at EthanGSN, Weiss at NYG Daily. You can follow the blog at GothamGSN, and you can follow me at TWENTEE7. We're everywhere. iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher Radio, Spotify. Subscribe, 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 unsubscribe, resubscribe, subscribe again. Follow us on everything. Weiss. How are you, my friend? How was that intro?
Wow, you did the intro better than Ethan does it. That was impressive. I was a little bit tempted to say no when you asked if you could do the intro, but that was incredibly well done. I got to give it to you.
Well, I just had my Spotify Wrapped come in, and for the third year in a row, I see NYG Weekly right at the top. So I feel like I've really put in my homework and know how this is starting to go.
Yeah, and you have Talking Sopranos at number one, which, by the way, if I was ever going to have something above me, it would have to be Talking Sopranos or anything Sopranos related. I'm okay with. If it was something else, I would have been mad at you.
There are only 17 weeks of the year, and you know, and the Sopranos have had 65 exactly. episodes that have all rolled out, so it
right.
You know, they can stack up a little easier.
So do they release episode every week?
So they've been doing one episode on a episode of the TV show, and they've got different cast members coming on for an interview, and they usually interview the cast member about their experience, and then they talk about the show. And it's oftentimes, you know, an actor who had a key role in that episode. I just finished up season two going through there, and they had David Provol, who played Richie in the second to last episode. Then they had Vinny Pistori, who played Pussy on the last episode of season two. So
Big Pussy? No, Little Pussy.
No, Big Pussy, Boot Pussy. We never saw Malenga on the screen.
Big Pussy, not Pizarro.
My Pussy.
Yep. Great show. Great show. I just finished watching it for the fourth time. And I just started Succession, by the way. And the reason why I bring that up is because Succession reminds me a lot of The Sopranos in terms of like some of the comedy and the dark humor. So I recommend people watch Succession. If you like The Sopranos, I think you'll like Succession. You can see some similarities.
My comment on that is I actually texted Ethan last week asking him how hard it would be to do a Succession intro with the Giants, because I think there are some parallels between the Roys and the Maras and the nepotism there as well, which I think is a great segue to this team that we both love to see drive us absolutely off the wall.
Yes. So the Miami Dolphins game. First of all, I didn't expect them to win that game. I didn't even expect them to win that game if Daniel Jones was healthy. I just think Miami is basically the Giants, but a better version. Like the current state of the Giants, like I think the Dolphins are similar. They're just a level up, if that sort of makes sense. They have a strong defense. Their offensive line is not good. They have some question marks at quarterback, obviously some question marks with the head coach, maybe not as much as the Giants, but you know, in the front office as well. A lot of fans are unhappy with their owner. But nonetheless, watching this game, there were like, even though I didn't expect them to win, and quite frankly, I didn't even want them to win. And I hate to admit that, but I really didn't want the Giants to win this game. But nonetheless, watching them and seeing some of their decision making, it made me want to bash my head through a window, because like, even though I don't think they're going to make the playoffs, and even though I probably am much more in favor of a total house cleaning, I desperately want Joe Judge to show me that he is a good head coach And week after week, he continues to make some sort of mistake that makes me be like, what the hell? Fire this guy immediately. And the decision not to go for it on fourth down, like, I want people to understand something, right? Like, I always hear this, and I heard it so many times after. How can you go for it on fourth down? Daniel Jones is not playing. It's a backup quarterback. He doesn't trust his quarterback. Understand something, okay? And you can correct me if I'm wrong, Will, but, like, if field position doesn't mean shit when your offense can't score. And when you get to fourth and manageable or fourth and short, and you have a very strong defense who has shown time and again that they can get stops, you go for it because, not because, well, I don't trust my offense, so I can't go for it. You go for it because of the trust you have in your defense. Because you know that even if I don't get it and I give the Dolphins the ball back at midfield, I still trust that my defense can get me a stop without giving up points. So, like, when you get to that point, and remember, points are at a premium in this game. Like, I know the Dolphins scored 20 points, but for the most part, this was a one-score game throughout the entirety of the game. And for the Giants, like, you need some sort of spark offensively. And it's not even about a spark. It's like you're not moving the ball. So when you get to a certain spot where you can extend the drive, it makes sense for you to go for it. And I hated it that after the decisions were made twice, actually, I just hear, well, it's a backup quarterback. Oh, he doesn't trust his offense. That's not the point. You're trying to exhaust every avenue to move the football because you know, and you're going for it on fourth down in that position because you know you have a defense that can get you a stop. So I hate when people bring up field position. I hate when Joe Judge talks about winning the field position battle. I hate it when people excuse this type of thing by looking at the personnel and offense and saying, well, this is why you can't go for it, because it doesn't make sense. You go for it. You need that fourth. You go for it on fourth down because you trust that your defense can get you a stop, because you know that your offense might not get back to this spot for a long time, and because you need to be able to score points in this league to win. And if you don't believe me, just go back and listen to Joe Judge on why he made the change with Jason Garrett, because they weren't scoring enough points. So I'll hand it over to you. There's plenty more to discuss, but in terms of those decisions, like, those can lose you a game. And it's already lost them games this season, his conservativeness. And it's tough for me to say, well, this is going to change if there's changes in the front office or if there's changes in personnel. I feel like he is a conservative coach, and it's going to cost the Giants games as it has this season.
So there's a lot that you touched on, and there's definitely a lot that I'm going to touch on. And I'm still going to try to answer that the best I can and definitely miss a lot of what you said. So we'll be doubling back. But
okay.
I was much more disturbed by, I think, the lack of game awareness than the fourth down decisions themselves. And I think everybody on Twitter was talking about the timeout burned at the end of the first quarter by not understanding how the clock runs out. You know, we talk about just the lack of preparation, and, you know, that we've seen the wrong delays of games, guys not knowing, you know, who's supposed to be on the field. Simple things like that that I think is very concerning. And one thing that I was really expecting from Judge, and that I thought that he was going to value from his opening press conference and from the values that he communicated, is I thought the Giants were going to be able to call two plays at a time, because the team would be situationally aware and say, okay, it's third and four. We get a big play, it's first down, we can do something else. We get stopped, it's fourth and four, we know what we're going to do, and because we're already ready, we'll have that extra advantage on the other team. We make it fourth and one, we'll know what we're doing then too, because we've practiced that. We know we're situationally aware, we know where we need to go, and you know where we need to go right now, and then what the next move is. You know, it's that 2-3 move combination that where the Giants have always been caught off guard. And that we haven't seen, and I think There are limitations, obviously, with the OL. I think the line is the limiting factor. The line and the quarterback are really what are limiting the offense right now. And I think that, you know, that's really what I want to see. And I agree with the problem, the criticism of Joe Judge's choice of words by saying, okay, I wanted to punt to trust my defense. I think by punting, he was trusting his special teams. And I think, you know, the special teams is a solid unit. But Riley Dixon, I think, is one of the five highest paid punters in the league. And he's been crap.
Yes.
And the Giants...
You pointed that out to me multiple times, by the way.
Yeah, I was talking about that a lot last year and going into this offseason. I thought he was a no-brainer cut. I thought, you know, the Giants clearly can use the money. It doesn't make any sense why... It feels like he's on a scholarship. And Judge wasn't even the one who traded for Dixon. That was a you know, a seventh rounder that was traded in 2018. And Dixon was great.
To Denver, right?
Yes, exactly. And Dixon was great you know, early on, but last year he wasn't good. And this year he's a liability. And if you can't pin the team deep, you can't even play that field position game. The Giants had a drive in the first quarter where they moved the ball from their own seven into Miami's territory. And then an interception through an interception, which was actually better than a Riley Dixon punt. They pinned the Dolphins inside the five, and they ended up gaining a net of 11 yards with the interception, and then forcing a punt, and then returning the punt to the Dolphins 35. That 11 yards wasn't gained necessarily on every drive the Giants had. I'm looking at a drive chart on CBS Sports right now. The Giants had three drives where they moved the ball and got first downs in the first quarter. And then after that, they only had two other drives for the rest of the game until they were down by, you know, 10 in the first quarter, in the fourth quarter, where they even gained 10 yards. I mean, going through the Giants' drive chart after the first quarter, they had 6 yards. They gained six plays for 23 yards, which was a punt. Then one play before the half. Then they had 10 plays for 69 yards that got a field goal to start the third quarter. Three and out, six plays for 2 yards. Three plays for negative 8 yards, 10 plays for 25 yards, which is just amazing.
Yeah, and then I remember that.
And then they had six plays to set up Gano's miss at the end. But it was, you know, the offense couldn't move the ball. So if you're going for it, there are two things that you need. You need to tell me that you're able to convert that fourth down, and you need to be able to say, okay, I'm converting the fourth down. I'm still able to move the ball and get points. And I think those, you know, the Giants want to be in a position where they can say, okay, I believe those two things. But I think it showed self-awareness to say, I'm not comfortable enough with this offense to say we need our offense to be the only ways we can get points. And it's not – I reject the idea that it's, okay, if we don't score on this drive, that means we're not choosing to be aggressive and try to score points. Joe Judge really believes in complementary football, and I think that's not as much of football in 2021 as it was in 2011, but it is still a part of football. And I think when you have a defense who can be opportunistic, when you have a quarterback on the other side who has shown that he makes questionable decisions, you pin that offense deep, you have as good of a chance to put yourself in a position to get points on the board as with an offense who's shown you that they can't move the ball. So I'm not necessarily saying that everything that it was the right decision, but I am saying that I think that there was a reasonable process that could lead to making that decision. And I think, you know, when it's fourth and two and you're down by four, it's different from when it's fourth and two and you're down by 11. And I understand making a different decision when those possessions have more of a premium at the end of the game. But that decision by itself didn't bother me. And I'll say the other piece of that is if you're at the 45 and you're trying to get that first down and you convert it, most likely with this situation, if things work out, you have a field goal attempt coming. I'm less bothered by that by a lot than if the Giants are already inside the opponent's 10 and they're playing for a field goal and saying, okay, I'll take those 3 points. Because, first of all, it's a lower probability field goal. But second of all, you already have that opponent pinned so deep. And I feel like that's really trusting your defense and saying, even if we don't score, our defense can get us the ball back. We're still close enough to getting those 3 points anyway. You know, that's trusting the offense and the defense. So I wasn't upset by those decisions, which I felt showed awareness to roster limitations, as I was by the general just lack of preparation.
I get it. I understand the lack of I understand there's a lot of that he doesn't trust a lot of the offensive personnel. I totally understand. And I understand what you're saying. But You're down 10-6. There's about, I think it was about 6 minutes left in the third quarter when they got the ball. It was first and 10 from the, I want to say it was the 45-yard line. It was just about midfield. And they got the ball after a punt by the Dolphins. And they get to fourth and two. They go from first and 10 from the Giant 46 to fourth and two from the Miami, I think, 46-yard line too. Yeah, I'm correct. Seeing here. And instead, and to me, and at that point, you almost, like, that is the spot you have to go for it, because you're down 10-6. It is the third quarter, right? One score, one touchdown by the Dolphins essentially ends the game, really. I understand there's a whole quarter left, but you're not moving the ball. I mean, prior to that, you know, there was a drive that went for no yards. And then after that, the Giants had a 6-play drive that went 2 yards, a 3-play drive that went -8 yards, right? So, and in between there, there was a touchdown drive for the Miami Dolphins to go up 17-6. So you not trusting your personnel, that's fine. But there are certain times, and you're right, this isn't conservativeness, this is more situation awareness. I'm in a 10-6 game. I got the ball at midfield, right? I got into Miami territory. I need 2 yards. Look at the way the game is tailored today. It's all tailored to the offense. You can get a holding penalty. You can get, like, the officiating favors the offense. You're at an advantage there. You only need 2 yards to get a first down, which will likely, if you get a first down, you're probably going to get a field goal out of that drive too, although obviously you don't know what the way the offense is. I just think in that spot, right, you have to go for it. Because you cannot trust the fact that you're going to get the ball back in a comfortable spot, like where they got it. And as we saw throughout, after that, they got the ball. They forced Miami to punt. They got the ball back, I believe, at their
own 15.
20-yard line. Yeah, their own 15 and something like that. They punted back, and then Miami went down and scored a touchdown. I just think you have to, in that place, I agree. Maybe it's not its conservativeness, but you have to have situational awareness. And in that spot, you need a touchdown, fourth and two from the 46, right? When you factor in everything in terms of the game of football today, with the offense, you know, getting favorable calls, with the fact that it's only 2 yards, with the fact that you're down 10-6 and points at a premium, with the fact that you have a strong defense that you can trust, where at the very least, you know, if I give the Dolphins the ball at the 46, I know my bend or don't break defense can hold them to a field goal. I just think you have to go for it. And this isn't the first time where we can chalk it up as, you know, he's got to change. This is something that's been going on since he took over as the head coach. And lack of trust in personnel, fine. But sometimes you have to just, I don't want to sound, you know, repetitive, but sometimes you just have to go for it. Sometimes you have to look at the situation and say, look, it's 10-6. We're in the third quarter, late in the third quarter. I'm not able to move the ball up the field from them. I got 2 yards to get to the 44 of the Dolphins. Let me just look at the probability of what I've seen from this game. And let me just go for it here rather than thinking that I can pin them and they give the ball back to me at wherever.
So I just think
you have to play winning football. Play to win. Like, that's my whole point here.
So, you know, and I think there are different pieces here, because a lot of people in our community praise teams like the Ravens and the Chargers for really understanding their identity, for playing to the analytics, and for understanding that their identity is picking up those fourth downs and leaving the ball on their quarterbacks. And that's great, but the Giants right now don't have that identity. And I think the closest thing we do have to an identity is a secondary that can stop the other team. And I wish I still, you know, I two iterations of my laptops ago, I did a Python project where I looked at like 15 years of play-by-play data and modeled NFL win probability using several different levers. And I found that when a team has the ball inside their own 15, but even inside their own 10, they the most likely scenario was the team on defense would get the next points, not the team on offense. So I do think that they were that there is some analytic, there is an analytic defense to the decision that the Giants made. And I understand what you're saying. You know, you've just got to go pick up those 2 yards. I can't come up with many plays with this offense that I would trust to make those 2 yard plays. I mean, I obviously hate the Kyle Rudolph signing, but maybe you try to get Kyle Rudolph open, but who knows how well that's going to happen. And that, you know, that means
They went for it on 4th and 2 a couple drives later.
Right.
That was at the 38, and they got it.
And they picked it up with Barkley running the ball. But that they succeeded, but that's not going to succeed every time. And I think we would agree that, you know, if they run that 10 times, you think they're going to get that more than 6? I mean, how many runs has Saquon Barkley had that have picked up 2 yards this year? What percentage? Probably not.
But as a coach who's trying to, you know, the way a coach looks at it is different than the way obviously fans look at it, especially Giant fans right now. But as a coach, you're trying to win a football game. I understand the defense. I understand, like, I get it. But you got to put, because here's the thing, Will. Like, this is what I want people to understand. We now have history of these types of decisions costing him games, like costing the team games. His conservative nature, lack of awareness of the situation, like that has cost him games. Washington, Atlanta earlier in the season, right? And I understand personnel-wise, they're outmatched by a lot of teams in the league, but they're not going against some, you know, an elite team in the AFC. They're going against the Dolphins, who, as I said, they're just a better version of the Giants. They're just more closer to mediocrity than the Giants are. So as a coach, you got to have some type of, you know, preparation where you're like, hey, we're struggling to move the ball. It's apparent the entire season. We need to put a focus on being able to get the short yardage stuff. So when we're in a position where it's 4th and short, from the opponent's 40-whatever-yard line, these are the plays I can turn to and say, hey, let's go for it here. I'm not saying he needs to go for it on every single 4th and short. I'm not saying that. Certain times you punt, that's fine. But there has to be some sort of package instilled in your offense where you can say, hey, look, this is the reality of the situation. We are struggling to score points in the National Football League. We're one of the league's worst. The last 3 games, only 2 offensive touchdowns. We need to be prepared, right? This is a big word in coaching, especially with Joe Judge. We need to be prepared for that situation where we're in a tight, low-scoring game like we have been in the past. We get the football. We have the football at midfield or, you know, in plus territory. We're at a 4th and short. We need to have a package there we can turn to, whether it's 3, 4, 5 plays, that we can go to 1 and we can get us 2 yards. This is, you know, like, We're not talking about, you know, 4th and 10. This is 4th and 2. Like, this is 2 yards. So there has to be some preparation for that. You can't just simply chalk it up as, well, I trust my defense. Well, fine. You trust your defense. But if you look at the history of your decision making, and when we talk about this, it's not worked out for you. So that's my whole point here.
Yeah, and I think the only counterpoint that I'll make to that is, I agree with a lot of the criticism of Judge being too conservative from early in the season in the Washington and the Atlanta games, but I don't want him to overreact by making the wrong decisions to try to make up for that. I think there's like I was just saying, there's a big difference between settling for a field goal and trying to play to the strengths of your defense by trying to pin the other team deep. And I know, you know, if you make that decision, you have to pin them deep, because obviously when you're only gaining 25 net yards, you know, what the hell are we doing? And that's what ended up happening.
Would you have gone for it there, 4th and 2, down 10-6?
In that specific situation, I think I would have preferred to punt. I really think I would have preferred to punt, because I think, you know, you have an offense that's shown that, like I said, you have an offense that hasn't shown you anything. And as much as I think I want to have a play that I can call, I don't feel like there's a play that fits that. And I think that a good punt puts the Giants in the best scenario to get the next points on the board.
So there's 600 coaches on that coaching staff, I think. I mean, there's an exorbitant amount of coaches.
And I want to actually talk about that, because I've made this point earlier in the season. Everybody was saying, I want to get rid of Garrett. And Dan Schneer, who joined a Twitter space with me last night, broke down the game, and he said that he saw more open receivers with Kitchens running the offense than he'd seen in a while. So I think that that's promising. But as much as everybody's been piling on Garrett, I've been, you know, me being contrarian, surprise, surprise, I've been had my sights set on Amos Jones, who's supposed to be our vice president coach of special projects. And like, he was touted for his game management, and the game management has clearly been disastrous. And I don't understand.
Is he also in charge of clock management? Like, is that the same
thing? I think so. And I think, you know,
then he knew. Get rid of him.
And I was celebrating the hire, because I was like, wow, we've got a coach who's specifically devoted to these areas that have been plaguing the Giants, going back to Tom Coughlin. And it's if anything, it's been even worse. So I think I will eat crow on that. But I want a beat reporter to ask what he's doing, what he's telling, like what he's saying, because, you know, I think you run into problems when there are too many cooks in the kitchen. And if this guy's responsibilities are the responsibilities where the Giants are most embarrassing ourselves, outside of some legacy personnel decisions, he's got to go. And I think, you know, Garrett's obviously the more high profile name, but the clock management and the game management has been no less embarrassing than the offensive scheme.
Do you think the Miami game was more bad coaching or bad execution?
I think the Miami game, I think it was a letdown spot. You know, they just had a divisional win, which validated a lot that shouldn't have been validated. Obviously, Jones not playing doesn't help, and the offensive line and the personnel. I mean, it was an uphill battle from the beginning. You know, the Dolphins were favored by 7 for a reason, and you were talking about all the similarities. The other thing that Giants and the Dolphins have in common, they play in front of Giants fans. I mean, you know, you look at the people who go to Dolphins games who live in South Florida.
Right.
But, you know, it was a very favorable crowd for the Giants, and they were laying 7 points getting 7 points for a reason. I think that it was personnel limitations as much as anything else. You have guys trying to do it all themselves because they don't, you know, they don't trust and buy into the scheme. And you know, I'm talking very specifically about offense, because I think the defense played very well.
Right.
I think, you know, we'd agree on that. But I think, you know, they're still figuring out this scheme with an offense that fired their offensive coordinator on a short week right after a bye week, which is just, you know, we talked about this last week, just embarrassing by itself. But I don't think there's much more that Judge could have done to have helped them win this game, I guess, is what it comes down to. You know, they could have looked less embarrassing for sure. But I don't see a lot of ways where it could have been a win.
I agree. I don't think there's much he could have done for them to win this game. And I'm harping on the fourth down decisions. I don't think that those fourth down decisions necessarily mean they were going to win the game. I just think that you got to put yourself in position to win. You can't put yourself in position to hope that your defense can get a stop. Like, I just think you got to play to win. But I agree with you in terms of the roster limitations. I also think that, you know, in the last 2 weeks, Freddie Kitchens' play calling doesn't have me, like, I've yet to get mad. Like, I know that people will look at the screen passes, but, like, if, like, I went back and I watched some of the screenplays, and some of it's, man, they don't know how to do the simple stuff. Like, their offensive line, they can't do a simple, like, they can't execute a screenplay very simply. Like, it's just, it's mind-boggling to me how these are NFL caliber linemen struggling to do that. And then execution wise, I mean, the drops, Saquon Barkley dropping the ball, not a good look. And then, you know, with the limitations, they are limited. But I don't think Freddie Kitchens has been, like, I don't think he deserves to be the offensive coordinator next year. But there's a clear upgrade there from Jason Garrett. That's not saying much, but I do, like, I don't mind a lot of the play calling, where with Jason Garrett, it was just, there were 3-4 times a game where you're just looking at it like, what the hell am I watching?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the offense is still severely limited, and I don't think it's going to be quite as embarrassing, but I don't think, you know, it's going to turn into a strength. And, you know, talking about next year all of a sudden, if we keep Judge, it's hard to see Patrick Graham getting a head coaching job right now. So if Patrick Graham's a defensive coordinator, an offensive coordinator taking this job, and I think there were some guys on the Twitter space I was in last night who did a very good job articulating this, and it wasn't something that I'd originally thought about. An offensive coordinator who'd come in would basically be would be joining a coaching staff that seems to be on fairly thin ice with a new GM who didn't pick that coach, and probably the interim coach in waiting already on the staff in Patrick Graham. So it's not really like there's that, okay, maybe I can showcase myself as an interim head coach. So it's, you know, it's going to be hard to sell, you know, the best candidates on that position, you know, especially with a limited pool of quarterbacks, especially with some financial considerations. So, you know, this is not, it's going to be hard to see, unless it's a complete disaster, really moving on from Kitchens, just for lack of a better alternative. You know, you talk about some of the things that the team can't do, like that are very simple. And I think having such a green offensive line with no experience playing next to each other, it hurts in that. And just given that it's December 8th and a good friend of mine's birthday, I want to mention something that he told me a few months ago. He's a diehard Ohio State fan. He goes to a lot of their home games. He knows, I'd say, more about Ohio State than you and I know about the Giants. And I say that in earnest.
Wow.
When the Giants traded for Billy Price, I asked him for his take. And what he said is, and there's no, you know, as much as, you know, what he knows what's able to be, no, he can't validate this. But what he said is he thought that Price's profile fit the profile of somebody who was a physical freak, possibly with the benefit of performance enhancing drugs. And that's an accusation that I don't want to throw out. But he said the way his body broke down basically fits the way that you see guys break down after they wane off those things. And it seems like Price was able to dominate in college on his physical abilities more than anything else, and he's just not getting it at the NFL level. So I think you know, there was some excitement of seeing an ex first round pick come in, and you know, it seems like the Giants have gone after a lot of those ex first round picks that didn't work out, which is already a red flag by itself. But it's just a really messy situation, you know, from top to bottom with that offensive line. It's hard to see a lot of this getting resolved outside of just getting really lucky. And, you know, the one thing that we're talking about having a hard time winning the game, another point that Dan made last night, is he said there was a play that Ojulari broke up a pass by tipping it, and had he not tipped that ball, Bradbury was there ready to take it to the house. And so I think that was the play after the Giants punted from the questionable punt, and then they punted back, and that was early on that drive that ended up being a Dolphins score. But that play goes the other way, and everything's flipped. So I don't think the Giants win if the way that Judge coached the game, you know, one out of two times. But they do win the game more than one out of five times. And I don't think that, you know, that might be better than just going toe-to-toe and saying, we're going to try to let our offense do this, and, you know, we're going to try to out-football you, would end up producing.
Yeah, it's a lot there with Billy Price. I just think when I look at their offensive line, like I was thinking about this while after the game, I was like, when was the last time I went into a season comfortable with the Giant offensive line? Now, that doesn't mean that I thought that their offensive line was good, but like you were comfortable. And I sat there and I thought and I thought and I thought, and I had to go back to 2014.
That's what I would have said too, because that was when you had J.D. Walton, who had just left, and you know, Weston was going to slide into the center, and everything was going to
right. So they had taken Weston Richburg with the second round pick, and that was supposed to be their day one center. But then he ended up playing guard.
Yeah, sorry. I was confusing 14 and 15. So they had signed J.D. Walton to play center, who had been out of football the year before, and who had been with the Dolphins the year before that. So he had basically taken a full year off from And they had Pugh, who had just been drafted, and they had Beattie, who was still.
That was the year they moved Pugh. They didn't move Pugh inside until 2015, I believe. Pugh was still the right tackle, right?
Yeah. If I can do this from memory, I think that offensive line was left tackle was Beattie, left guard was Richburg,
right.
Center was J.D. Walton, like we're saying. Right guard, I think, was Jerry coming in, or was that somebody before him?
So I remember that was the same offseason they signed Jeff Schwartz to that big contract. Remember, you're right. You're right.
You're absolutely right.
So I think
right.
what happened was Schwartz got hurt. Was the right guard. Schwartz got hurt. They had to move Richburg to guard and then play J.D. Walton at center, right?
And was that the year that they still had Newhouse, or did Newhouse come in the next year? Because that was the year
Newhouse came in a year later. Yeah.
Okay, so then Pugh was playing right tackle. That's right, because Pugh was playing right tackle. Yeah. Okay.
So their offensive line was, like, coming into training camp, their offensive line was Beatty, Jeff Schwartz, who they signed in free agency, Weston Richburg, who they drafted. Their right guard was...
Schwartz.
Schwartz was the left guard. What's his name was the center?
Richburg no, because Walton was the center in camp, and Walton... I think because Walton, I think Walton ended up having the job over Richburg. I don't know if Richburg ever had the center job to lose, and I think he started in as a guard. So I think the original guards were Schwartz and Richburg, and then Pugh was the right tackle where he was originally drafted.
It was John Jerry. John Jerry was the right guard. So this, now I remember, they brought in John Jerry, and they brought in Jeff Schwartz. The offensive line was supposed to be left tackle Will Beatty, left guard Jeff Schwartz, Weston Richburg at center, John Jerry right guard, Justin Pugh right tackle. What messed everything up was when Schwartz got hurt, they had to take Richburg, who was a rookie, play him at guard. He was not a good guard. Play J.D. Walton at center. J.D. Walton was not a good center.
He had been out of football John the Jerry year before, Justin yeah. Pugh.
Right. So that messed up their interior offensive line. But prior to that, I was totally behind a Beatty, Schwartz, Richburg, John Jerry, Justin Pugh offensive line that I was comfortable with going into the season. Unfortunately, that broke down before we even played.
And John Jerry in 2014 was a different player than the John Jerry people remember from 2017. I think, he had been a starter with the Dolphins, and they had been a fine, yeah. So I felt the same. I think that's about the same time I would point to too. Because in 2013, the year before, the Giants went into the year expecting Chris Snead to be their right guard, and he retired. And in a lot of ways, they really haven't been able to replace him even nine years later.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't replaced anybody outside the left tackle 9 years later, right? Like, they've tried, but no long-term solution. With the offensive line, it's just been – you just worry every single week, and I just think that – I don't know when it's ever going to be fixed. We'll see. I'll believe it when I see it. With this offensive line, I mean,
I do want to make a point that I made outside of Andrew that I Thomas, made yesterday.
Left tackle. Yes.
Yes. So the point that I want to that I do want to make is I do see much more progress in building that offensive line in the last 2 years than I saw in the first 2 years of the Gettleman tenure, because the guys who are being brought in, are potential pieces for the long-term offensive line. It's not Nate Solder, Patrick Omame, Kevin Zeitler, right. Mike Remmers, who are, not necessarily deficient players by the time they're being brought in, but they're here for now, not here for tomorrow. They're here, and in the back of your head, you already have to replace them, down the road. So, with
Can
Thomas...
Can I ask you a question about when you brought up Nate Solder? I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
I am, with free agency... I've learned to be very, I worry about throwing big money around, but if there is a guard or a tackle that I look at who's fairly young, playing at a above average elite level, I'll throw one out there who's going to be a free agent this offseason. He's playing on the franchise tag right now. Brandon Scherff. He's 29 right now. He'll be 30 by the time, week one happens of next year.
Former Giants future first round draft pick.
Yeah, remember that? I wouldn't mind throwing money at that to be a guard on the Giants, because I know the Giants can't fill all their remaining spots in the draft, even though with two draft picks, I think they're going to have to, if they want to sort of expedite the process, they're going to have to spend money, and I'm okay with that. But are you okay with, Nate Solder was a mistake, and you were right from the get-go. I mean, he was done in New England. But somebody like Brandon Scherff, who's playing at an elite level, who's 30, but could give you maybe 2 years, 3 years of stability at one spot on your offensive line.
Yeah, I think.
Would you, be okay with that?
It all depends on the market. It depends on a lot of things, the way things shake out. You saw the guard market last year just get toasted by, every guard who was cut was signing for 50%, as much as he'd originally had. And I think that trend might continue. So if there's a discount available, I love that idea. But I think what's most important is that you have guys developing who are used to playing next to each other. And, that's what made the 2007 to 2011 line so special. They were not all amazing players, but they knew how to trust each other. They knew how to have Chris Snee next to Kareem McKenzie be better than just Chris Snee by himself next to Kareem McKenzie by himself. There was the cohesion there that I think is missing more than anything else. So I think, I think they've got to look at a lot of options because they're going to have to bring in guys who are going to ultimately get cut, which is kind of what I thought was ending up happening this last offseason with John Ross. It's good to have a guy who's a good player that you can't fit on the team. It's bad to be in a position where we have so many holes. We have Matt Peart. We can't necessarily move on from him when we have so many other positions in the roster that need to be improved. So we've just got to hope Matt Peart works out. And I think the Giants had enough room for improvement all throughout their roster that I don't necessarily kill them for not saying Owell has to be upgraded because there were some pieces there. And obviously the injury luck on the offensive line has just been a disaster. But, I just like I think that I have more confidence that there are potential long-term pieces now than I have in a long time. At the end of 2018...
Outside of Andrew Thomas, what's the long-term piece that you can look at right now?
Well, I don't think there is one outside of Andrew Thomas, and that's because of injuries. Okay. Because just I did think short. Nick Gates was a long-term piece,
right.
Obviously we don't know if he's ever going to play again, but I think right. that the way they coached up and developed Nick Gates and have invested in him, I think that's been a terrific process, and I think I think Gates is a solid player with fundamentals, but he's also got awesome the attitude yeah. that the Giants really right. need. And I think
he's a captain.
Yeah, and I think you put that next to Hernandez, who I think is also has that attitude that the Giants need, but he doesn't have the fundamentals down, and that's why
he's just a bad player. Yeah,
yeah, I have a hard time because he's bad, Will. I love him he's as bad, a person. Will. No, he's a liability on the offense. I get yeah. that, but that attitude is so missing from the Giants that there's still some that it bothers me to just write him off and just be like, oh, he's crap. Because, a lot of fans have a tendency to say, okay, this is a person who's dominating their assignment or he's trash. And there's so much room in between that. But I agree that he's playing a lot closer to the latter.
I think with the offensive line, you bring up the nastiness. I love Andrew Thomas. You know how much I love Andrew Thomas. I wish he forms a little bit more nastiness. I think he's a little bit too quiet for being an offensive lineman. But that's a different thing. But I think with the offensive line, I think you have to – now, people are going to think that I'm crazy, but you sort of have to expedite this building of your offensive line. You have to find four capable starters by next year. And with two first-round picks, two third-round picks, I am inclined to think that – you have to start two rookies next year, right? You have to draft too high next year where they can start. And I think you're going to have to spend some money. And the reason why I'm okay with overspending on an offensive lineman is because if you can find stability, I mean, you talked about it, you want stability on your offensive line. You want guys that have been playing next to each other, not bring in a guy or trade for a guy in August without going through training camp, and then all of a sudden he's plugged in as a day one starter. No, I think you have to find long-term stability. And to me, long-term stability on a football roster is 2 years. Like that, I would consider that long-term stability, excluding quarterback. I'm talking about every other position. And if you can get, and I throw this example out there, I was just looking at free agent offensive linemen next year and sort of seeing what their market value could be. I mean, Brandon Sheriff, I know he's going to be 30, but he's a good offensive guard. And I think if you can plug him into one of your guard spots and you go out and you draft a tackle and then later on you draft a center or a guard, I think having four of your five spots solidified for at least the next 2 years, to me, that goes a long way. And I think that they have to sort of be aggressive in that, because understand, regardless who the quarterback is next year, who the head coach is next year, they have to be able to find stability on their offensive line. It can no longer be, you know, just patchwork. That's why I'm all for using both first-round picks on an offensive lineman if you need to, because you got to stabilize this offensive line. You have to do it.
Yeah, I agree that, you've got to stabilize the offensive line. I mean, I would be more excited about bringing in a guy like, you know, a legend on the offensive line, like a Bill Callahan or a Dante Scarnecchia, if that's possible. I don't think either will be available, but then bringing in high pedigree players, because I feel like there are a lot of good offensive lines. Just one high pedigree. Okay. I mean, that, you know, I could maybe get behind that.
They won't be able to buy four offensive linemen.
You draft a guy like that kid out of Iowa or something at center, maybe, you know, something like that, you know, right. I can get behind that. But I think, I don't necessarily think, you know, they'll need superstars to fix that. But I think, yeah, the line's a problem, but, like you always talk about, you can't say like, okay, we didn't make the right decisions for the last several years, but we haven't been good for a long time, so we're due for a year five of a five-year plan without having the years 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so I'm just always much more conservative about saying, okay, now is our time to be aggressive and build this offensive line that can actually work. It's tricky because obviously, as we both know, the Giants are going to be looking for money more than they're going to be able to spend money going into next season.
I'm willing to sacrifice James Bradbury if it can bring us an average or above average offensive lineman.
So yeah, I think some, just spitballing, some pretty obvious cuts going into next year. Riley Dixon, I would say, I would probably add Sterling Shepard and Blake Martinez. I think, you know, Shepard's one of my favorite guys, but he can't stay on the field. And the Giants really work their roster to, there's not really room for him if everybody's healthy in general. So it doesn't make sense to have so much money going to three different wide receivers if you're trying to have a run first offense. I obviously, you know my thoughts about
first offense.
You know my thoughts about trading the running back, and then I think that, you know, I think Bradbury is a name. Did I already mention Blake Martinez?
No, you didn't.
I think Blake Martinez will get cut, and I thought that.
But you mentioned all these guys, and I always get this question a lot on Twitter, and I wanted to address it about how are we such in cap hell, right? Why is that? Well, you bring this up all the time when someone restructures a contract. When you restructure a contract and you open up salary cap space for today, what you're doing is you're taking money and you're moving it to tomorrow. So when the Giants restructured all these contracts last year or this year, what they ended up doing is it made it more difficult to move on from players that would have been easy to move on from after the year, correct? Like it would have costed less to move on from Sterling Shepard. Now it's not costing as much as now it's costing them more because they're going to have to take on more dead money. Same thing with James Bradbury. Same thing with Blake Martinez. So when people say restructure, 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 it's all fine and dandy. But then when it comes time where you're, holy shit, I got to free up cap space now, the cap space that you could have freed up is not nearly as much as what it is now.
Yeah.
And
that's exactly it. You know, right now, the Giants are using 22 money to pay for 2021 because they're using 2021 to pay for 2019 with Kevin Zeitler and Golden Tate. And frankly, even the $17 million that went to Eli that wasn't saved to start paying those bills. And I you've heard me say this way too many times, and most people who are listening, this won't be new to you. The Giants haven't accepted that they made bad spending decisions really in the mid-2010s. From 2014 to 2016, including the Jeff Schwartzes and the class of 2016 on defense, and they haven't swallowed up their money and eaten that cost. And we kind of alluded to this last week. That's what the Eagles are doing this year. The Eagles have basically said, okay, this is the year where we're going to get all that bad money spent, so next year we'll have money going forward. And that's why I don't really care and say, okay, wow, we kicked their, you know, we kicked their tails. They're positioning them. This year is about next year for them. Exactly. And that's frankly why, you know, I've always said that 2018 is cast, and obviously pre-2018 cast a shadow on 2018. So I don't blame Dave Gettleman for the losing in 2018. I blame him for spending money from 2020 and 2019 and 2021 in 2018. And that's frankly why I'm of the opinion where if you've told me that I need to stop talking about 2018 before this season, I'm completely disinterested in you wanting to move on from Joe Judge.
Yep. I was talking to somebody who covers the NFL on a more national scale. I was going through DMs with him, and he told me this thing that sits with me, you know, ever since I heard it was, when your team signs a free agent, if your first question is, well, how quickly can I get out of the contract? That's probably a bad free agent signing. There's been a lot of times that the Giants have signed a player and we've been like, okay, well, how quickly can we get out of this? Right? So
you gave me credit for seeing through the Solder. You gave me credit for seeing through the Solder signing. I want to talk about that for a second because I was right about that, but I was not right for the for the right reasons, for like great football knowledge or for being able to see a decline in Solder that the experts didn't see. I simply didn't think that the benefit Solder would add to 2018 or to 2019 and the best case scenario of what the Giants could achieve would be worth the cost of having to get out of that contract in 2020 and 2021. And it was simply about, you know, the positives versus the negatives. And as Gettleman said himself, you know, in validating the ridiculous Leonard Williams trade, which led to another dead money addition with Red Ellison, the juice was worth the squeeze. No, it was not worth the squeeze. And in 2018, you knew that Nate Solder had already played his best football. You knew that Connor Barwin had already played his best football. And you know, you couldn't see like, okay, maybe Connor Barwin's going to come in here and have a career best year. I hated the 2018 offseason. I thought it was probably the worst offseason in NFL history, and it's certainly aged that way. 2021, I had a lot of problems with the Giants' free agency offseason in general. I thought they paid too much for Golladay, Rudolph, Booker, and Adoree Jackson.
Right.
But with the exception of Rudolph,
I like the Adoree Jackson signing.
I didn't know with
the
certainty.
The Golladay signing I was a little bit iffy on.
So
I was going to say, was that because of
the length of the deal or the player?
The other two I was a little bit iffy on.
Well, so
the player, but the player. I really like Adoree Jackson.
Where though I found so much progress and improvement from 2021 was if somebody said to me, there's a chance that this player hasn't played their best football for any of those guys except for Rudolph, I wouldn't automatically think that person was insane. And, you know, just that as like a very, very embarrassingly low bar, the Giants cleared that. Like, there's a chance that Adoree Jackson would play better football year six than he did in year three. That's possible. It's not a sure thing, but it's possible. And so, you know, there's a chance that Kenny Golladay continues to improve and develop into an even better wide receiver. It's possible. So I think that I didn't love the direction and I hated the way that the money was continued, you know, that the can was kicked down the road and setting up the next GM for, some real difficult decisions. But the offseason didn't add just complete has-beens. And, you know, when you're coming from such a bad spot, that's progress, as sad as it is to say.
Yep. So as much as we want this season to end, it's there's still, you know, five more games left. And I said this after the Tampa Bay game when everyone was like, well, they got some easy games coming up. I didn't necessarily agree. I thought, you know, the NFL is so – there's so much parity that teams that you look at their record, they might have a record similar to the Giants, but they're playing a lot better. And I think they weren't going to win as many games as people thought. Now you factor in the injuries that the Giants have, especially with the quarterback. I wanted to go through game by game. Obviously, we'll start with the Chargers. Do you think the Giants are going to beat the Chargers on Sunday?
I do not think the Giants beat the Chargers on Sunday.
My first question is, Do you think Daniel Jones plays again this season?
I don't know enough to really have that decision, but I would say...
Are you going with the carpenter, or are you going with Joe Judge?
I really pride myself at being able to read a news story and not take it as gospel and kind of keep it in perspective. I would be more surprised than not if Jones plays again this year, because, you know, with the long-term potential damage, knowing that the Giants aren't going to be competing for a playoff spot, there just seems to be, you know, if this team were 7-5 instead of 4-8, I'd say we could probably get him back for maybe a week 16 or something like that. But I just don't even think it's going to be worth it.
I don't think he's going to play again this season. I think his season is over. I think they're holding out hope, but to me, who sold me on this was Pro Football Doc, who I listen to sometimes, yep, especially when the Giants player's injury.
He always says, I hope it's not the case, but.
Yes, exactly. One of the things he pointed out was typically when a quarterback specifically goes to see specialists, the fear is some sort of nerve issue. So those take time to heal, probably won't get cleared to play until that nerve issue settles. So I would be stunned if Daniel Jones plays again. I'm at that point right now. But who knows? There's been a lot of mixed messaging from the Giants. So, Chargers, you have them losing. That'll put them at 4-9. Then they host the Dallas Cowboys.
That, actually, I'm not sure.
Wow. Well, gun to your head.
Win or they lose? Gun to my head, I'd say they lose. You know, they're gonna be like an 8.5 point home dog or whatever. But that's a game that I think, you know, I think that's gonna be a game where like the Giants win the first half by 3 and then get blown out in the second half. Like I think they haven't
beaten Dak Prescott since Dak Prescott's rookie year in 2016.
Yeah, that's true. Because he was out for their win in Week 17 last year.
Looking at the schedule, I think that game, that December 19th game, might be a game where if the Cowboys win, they clinch the NFC East. So I could definitely see a scenario where they have that extra motivation and they come out and win that game. So that's 4-10. Then they go at the Eagles, who could be playing for a wild card spot. So do they win that game at the Eagles? They haven't won in Philly since 2013, when Chip Kelly was the coach,
that was another Week 17 game.
That wasn't a Week 17 game. That was the middle of the season game.
Barkley game. Yeah, Matt Barkley, right? Was it Matt Barkley?
When they kicked field goals. Yes.
Yeah.
And Chip Kelly was the coach, and the Giants kicked field goals
because they started 0-6, and then they went on a 4-game winning streak. If you're listening now, by the way, with the current state of the roster, I feel confident enough to say that this year will not be an exception, and that the 2013 season where the Giants started 0-6 will be the Giants' second best season in the last 9 years.
All right, so that is another loss that will put the Giants at 4-11. Whew. And then they go at Chicago, and to me, this is my playoff game.
Yeah.
Not because...
For the pick?
Because I win regardless. Yeah. So if the Giants win, the Bears pick is more valuable.
The
Giants pick is more valuable.
I will say what I said last night. If Matt Nagy is on the Bears sideline, I'm predicting a win. If they have an interim head coach, I think the Giants lose to the interim head coach.
No, I think the Giants win this game regardless. I think they win this game. I even give you a score. I could see this game is going to play out exactly like the Eagle game did. Low scoring. I'm going to say 13-10, Graham Gano game-winning field goal in Chicago. And we all come away after that game saying it was a win, but damn, Graham Gano has been such a great player for the Giants. And everyone's talking about Graham Gano's the MVP of the Giants this year of a 4-and-whatever team. So I think they win that game. They go to 5-11. Then they host Washington, who I think Washington is going to make the playoffs. Looking at the NFC right now, I think they're going to be the 7th seed. And I think that game is going to be a win and in scenario for Washington. And I know people will say, well, we got to get our revenge for Washington from last year. I just think Washington's defense is playing really well. Heinicke's playing really well. Who knows where the Giants are on January 9th? Who knows what the state of the organization is, what the feel is? But I think they lose that game.
Yeah, I think.
I think they win one more game.
I think
it's going to be Chicago.
I think that could be fairly accurate. You know, we don't know what we're going to have at the quarterback position. It seems like we probably are going to have the 32nd best quarterback of all NFL teams. It's going to be hard to find games. But I think, you know, the way Judge coaches, which is not necessarily a good thing, you know, a lot of people would say it's not a good thing. But the way Judge coaches, I don't think the Giants are going to show up and have a 0% chance of winning with any game that's left. So I think, you know, the ball can bounce a few ways and lead the Giants I think
the Giants are going to get blown out in Los Angeles this week. I think this game is going to be very similar to the game against the Rams. But all the other games, I think they're going to be close, including the Dallas game.
So listen to something. You know, I told you I had a little stat I was calculating right before we hopped on this together. So Dave Gettleman was hired in 2013 to be the general manager of the Carolina Panthers. Two years after he was hired, the 2015 Panthers went 15-1 and reached the Super Bowl. That 2015 team that went 15-1 had 9 All-Pro players, either first or second team. Actually, the only second team All-Pro was generational mentor Jonathan Stewart. With those 9 All-Pros, seven of eight first-team All-Pros were Panthers before Dave Gettleman. So he inherited a wonderful situation there. As a Panthers general manager with 5 seasons, he went 51-28-1, obviously starting with a very advantageous situation. Well, if they lose this week to the Chargers, he is down to .500 as a career general manager. And if John Mara decides to wait for him to get down to .500 and say, okay, now you're fired, so you can, you know, no longer have the benefit of being a career .500 general manager on your resume, I'm a John Mara stan again, because I think that would just be, I don't think this is what's going to happen. But kind of like Dave Gettleman screwed Eli's record over by not moving on from him at the right time and ending up having him retire with a career .500 regular season record, it would be nice to see the shoe placed on the other foot.
You bring up that Carolina thing. I think a lot of Ron Rivera, if you take away that 15-1 season from Ron Rivera, he's a below .500 coach. And I know he's doing a good job in Washington to their standard, but I'm just putting it out there. I think a lot of people have sort of exploited that 15-1 Carolina Panthers season more so than the person who I think deserves the most credit, which was their GM at the time.
Marty Herney, yeah.
I'm drawing blanks on his name.
Marty Herney.
Right. He's the one guy that has not been taking the credit, which I think he's the one that deserves the most credit because he drafted a lot of those players. But you're right. I mean, it's Dave and his resume. He's the only one that thinks he has a good resume. But let's talk about, so specifically this Sunday, we don't think they're going to win. I don't know who's going to start at quarterback, whether it's Mike Glennon or Jake Fromm. I'm of the indication, let Jake Fromm play. I don't think he's the answer or the long-term solution. But, I mean, what do you have to lose at this point? I mean, what is there to lose?
I think the only tangible answer that I have is kind of what, you know, our mascot, Saquon Barkley, said after the game last week, which is that there's eventually the defense is just going to be fed up with the dysfunction from the offense, like we saw in 2017. And if Jake Fromm is even worse than Mike Glennon and not, you know, Mike Glennon protected the ball. If Jake Fromm can't protect the ball and the offense can't move, then you can have those mutinies where you have guys calling each other cancers. I mean, I don't think anybody really cares enough about the Giants to call somebody else a cancer on this current roster.
I actually think a lot of Giants fans are rooting for that because they want more dysfunction, because they think more dysfunction is going to lead to more changes.
You'd mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that you weren't necessarily rooting for a win. And
no,
I wasn't either. And on Sunday at the Eagles game, one of my favorite guys in the section, who's always up on third downs on defense, pumping his chest, you know, he said to me, you know, I hope they fucking lose this game, you know, under his breath. He was there with his kids. But, like, you know, it's just fans are broken. And, you know, it's yes. not about the draft pick. It's about not having excuses for what we all know was wrong and we've known for a long time was wrong. And even Carl Banks has really come around to echo right. a lot of what we've been saying for a long time. And
company man Carl, that's what I used to call him.
I remember, you know, I don't forget a thing. But but Carl, right. you know, Carl isn't like us. He's been in the locker room and he knows
right.
the feeling of we just got to block out the outside noise. So he looks at things differently and with wisdom that we just can't have. But and we see things that Carl doesn't look at. We look at, I think, down the road, I think, more than Carl will be inclined to. But in 2018, right. I felt that there were free agents. You know, people were talking about Gettleman adding veteran presences and mentors. And I thought that people were taking advantage of Giants basically to get a fat check on their way out of the league. And in 2019, that was being communicated. And when Golden Tate signed immediately after the Giants had cleared $37 million of long-term money by trading Odell Beckham, and they immediately, you know, waste half of that on signing Golden Tate, Carl captioned that with a tweet saying, just as folks predicted, no one would want to sign with NYG. Well, 2.5 years later, Carl was wondering out loud on his podcast with Bob Papa yesterday, are people coming to New York for a money grab? Kind of what we've been saying for years.
I don't think he's wondering that. I don't think he's wondering that. I don't think he's wondering that, by the way.
I think he's recognizing that.
I think that is a informed...
Yes.
No, I think he knows that. Somebody has told Carl something, and Carl is sharing that in the form of an opinion. That's what I believe. Carl Banks would not just say that out loud.
No, I'm not sure, because I listened to what he said, and he didn't say it. I mean, you know, maybe he was hiding it, but I would be inclined as to say
Carl's very careful with his words.
He's very careful with his words. Exactly. He cares yeah. about, you know, so he knows, he's, say he's that, not no he's not going to embarrass a player. But what he was saying, the way I remember him communicating his point was, it feels like I was wondering to myself, are the Giants a destination for a money grab? And that's not to me somebody saying, you know, wow, you know, I can you know get $4 million here or $6 million there. That's him saying, what's this guy doing here? And thinking like, if I were in the shoes, you know, because he left the Giants at the end and played two years with the Browns. So whatever the situation right. is, when guys are coming to play somewhere for a money grab, the general manager is failing in his role of letting players play and letting coaches coach. And when guys are coming here for a money grab, they don't have that, you know, that loyalty from draft day to the Giants that guys like Odell Beckham and guys like Landon Collins really had. And I think it's hard to think that people are as invested, you know, obviously there are guys on the team who are professional. And I'm not saying that everybody who's not visibly angry is unprofessional or doesn't care, but it's not the same. You know, I don't think Leonard Williams has the same loyalty to the Giants that Landon Collins had. And I think that's the general manager's failure to put together a locker room that's going to give a shit in the right way.
Let me put you on the spot. Let me put you on the spot. Does Saquon Barkley have that loyalty to the Giants?
So I think Saquon Barkley's situation is actually worse, because you know you have the 2017 season where Landon Collins calls Eli Apple a cancer on the air, and right. Saquon Barkley's mandate is not to make the Giants win football games. It's, you know, to do things with class, like, you know, to not walk away from the Kyle Rudolph contract when you know that he's actually injured and failed his physical. And I think Saquon is not going to ruffle feathers. You know, Saquon is going to say the right things in an interview. So I think Saquon is complacent. I think that he's concerned with what happens off the field. I think he's very...
he's very proud of his, you know, of his play, and I think he feels a loyalty to his teammates. And you know me, looking for receipts. 3 years ago, tomorrow, Saquon Barkley dropped a pass against Washington, and license plate guy was on the sideline. He said 26 just went up and down the entire sideline saying, "My bad, my bad, my bad," you know, which is a little bit of corny accountability, but it's also still that accountability. So I think with Barkley, like, I think he wants, nobody should have any more reason to feel more loyalty to the Giants than he is, because the Giants basically laid down on a train track for this guy. But I don't think it's about the Giants winning. It's about, you know, the brand of the Giants. And I don't think he's, you know, he's not that guy who can do things with intention, like Carl was saying, like a guy who can just put the game into his hand and who other players fear disappointing. That's the part that I think is that I really want to talk about. Guys would be afraid to disappoint a guy like Brandon Jacobs, like Michael Strahan. Saquon is too nice. And I don't think the Giants have that dog that, you know, will scare people into doing what's right, what needs to be done.
I think it's because a lot of fans know it was the wrong pick. I think players know it too.
Players know. Saquon Barkley at this point knows that
you were a mistake.
Knows that he shouldn't, like, that he should never have been a Giant. And you know, I think it's I point to that what you know, I think most of everything he's done since being a Giant has been the right thing and done with class and integrity. And I think he's a terrific human being.
Right.
One exception to that is when he said going into the 2019 draft, you know, hey, you know, congratulations to everyone being picked. You know, who knows what fans are going to say? Hell, I won Rookie of the Year and still a lot of fans thought I was a bad pick. And he had like the laughing face. He's not going to post anything like that ever again. Ever again. Saquon Barkley will be, whatever he does on the field, as I've known from draft day, as you've probably known from draft day, Saquon Barkley will be remembered as a draft lesson, not for what he does on the football field. And that's what Dave Gettleman and John Mara decided from day one.
I agree with you. So we'll leave with this. What do fans look forward to for the next 5 weeks? I'll tell you what I'll tell fans, and you can tell me what you tell fans. I believe, and this is, I'm not going to call it an informed opinion, but okay, you know what? I'll call it an informed opinion. I believe once the Giants are eliminated from playoff contention, there will be some sort of announcement from ownership about a change that's coming.
Yeah, I think actually, and maybe it's hopeful thinking, but I think after, if the Giants get embarrassed this week, I don't think Dave Gettleman's on the sideline against Dallas. And I think
what you'll get is, you won't get a firing in season, but you'll get a statement saying so and so is stepping down at the end of the year.
No, I don't know. I mean, and you might, you know, you've had a track record of knowing.
That's all I'm going to say.
But I think
it won't be Ben McAdoo, Jerry Reese, you're fired. It will be at the end of the year, I'm stepping away.
He
says I'm stepping away right now.
And you can listen to the 40th minute of the second to last Bob Poppin, Carl Banks podcast, and. You know, I was at the field level at the sideline. And I was reminding Dave Gettleman about some of the promises he made and some of the contracts he gave him. I asked how it was possible that Golden Tate just signed for Tennessee without them having to commit $23 million. Like, you know, what could be going on there? But, you know, they know from the way that fans react, even from the way Carl's reacting, that this man has failed. He's failed in multiple fronts, because he failed his first time. He failed his second time. You know, he's failed with so many different. And it's funny. He's taken both sides of the same argument and failed on both sides. Exactly.
He got a reset button, and he failed twice.
Well, I think
he failed 2018, 2019. Then he failed 2020, 2021.
I don't know if the 2020 and 2021 failures are as much a failure or as much as just a reminder of the magnitude of his original failure. And I would argue that it's more the latter.
2020 and 2021 are not from a, if you look at it from a perspective, like we compare 2020 and 2021 to 18 and 19, right? And we say it's better than that. But if you look at it from a perspective of when you came in, what the issues were, they're the same thing. They have overpriced contracts on their roster. They don't have an offensive line. That's where you failed. You did it. The first 2 years you failed, right? And now 2020-21, you're failing the same exact way.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, that's why I was so gung-ho about, you know, and obviously, you know, that's why I thought, you know, there's zero reason to keep this guy after 2019, because it wasn't a failure of like, you know, it's not like, you know, in Harry Potter with flu powder and, you know, you show up in the right fireplace magically or something like that. And maybe next time, you know, you'll happen to hit the right number. It was the Giants were still years away from getting to that right place. And I kept asking, how are we going to evaluate his performance in 2020 and 2021? Because I think the 2020 offseason was phenomenal. I think the draft was great. And we've talked about guys from the top of the draft, guys from the middle of the draft, and guys from the bottom of the draft who look like they could be here. The free agents were front-loaded deals. They were guys who made an impact. I thought, you know, the 2020 offseason was terrific. That was not where Dave Gettleman failed. When he's fired, it's because finally we've run out of excuses and we've lost counter arguments to what everyone frankly could have told you as from day one. No, one more shot with Eli is not going to work, and going all in for one more shot with Eli will create more problems than it will solve. To answer your question, because I did get away from that, is what fans can look forward to.
Right.
You want to look forward to that development from those young guys. You want to see, can McKinney keep elevating? Can McKinney, you know, be that guy to win games? Look at the edge position. Ojulari, can he make the jump from a guy who can make a play when things are going right to a guy who can disrupt any given play? And on the other side, Quincy Roche, can he be that, you know, close to an every down edge rusher for us? Because the Steelers cutting their sixth round pick was one of the best things that have happened to the Giants edge position since Dave Gettleman was hired, which is just, you know, embarrassing.
That is crazy. You're right. It's embarrassing. Well, listen, well, I thank you for coming on short notice. You're always available. Follow him 20T7. That's TWENTE number 7. We're both telling you that the Giants are going to lose. Is it going to be hurt? Is it going to hurt you watching Justin Herbert, knowing that the one decision that Dave Gettleman might have gotten right ended up not happening because Justin Herbert went back to school?
I will say, not only say I don't know, but I will say no, because I don't scout quarterbacks, and I didn't think Herbert was going to be as good as he's looked. And I will also say that in 2019, I did not want a quarterback because I thought that the 2018 damage with, you know, the spending and the lack of additional draft capital, et cetera, I thought it would basically set the Giants up for, at the end of this rookie contract, we wouldn't know what we had. We wouldn't have been able to win under that rookie deal. And I basically would have rather extended that potential rookie window by drafting a Josh Allen or something like, you know, the edge rusher and waiting until drafting Josh Allen, trading maybe a second for Josh Rosen, failing with him, getting Eli off the books, and, you know, and doing the things to have the money to start building. Because, you know, Jones took over, and we talk about Kevin Zeitler, maybe the best player on the Giants offense was a guy who was here as a rental with a dummy year that was eventually going to have to be moved. It was a, you know, so no, Herbert won't kill me. I will, you know, be a lot more upset if I see a concession guy in the stands with a hot pretzel. But I think
I love Justin Herbert coming out in 2019 was the year that everyone thought he was going to come out.
Right.
I really, really enjoyed him. I really, really wanted him. And then after that, when he went back to school that year, he didn't really impress me. It was almost like he regressed a little bit.
Yeah, because he's
just the player that I thought he was going to be.
He had a shot at being drafted number one overall in 2019 if he came out that year. And his
Over Kyler Murray?
I think so. Just because
I think going, Arizona was set on Kyler Murray.
Maybe, yeah, with
maybe
Arizona.
Number two overall pick,
maybe,
yeah.
Maybe with Arizona with that pick, I'd agree with you. But depending on who's picking that, I don't think 32 teams take Kyler Murray over Justin Herbert. And I think the same draft board in 2020 comes up in 20, like, you know, after Justin Herbert's 2018 year instead of his 2019 year, I think Herbert goes higher. Because I like you were saying, I think he hurt his draft stock with the above average, not spectacular 2019 season.
Yeah, but it's going to hurt me watching Justin Herbert, just because I was a huge fan. I actually put money on him winning MVP this year, by the way, too. He was my dark horse. Nonetheless, well, not going to happen, but...
That's better than those bets on Saquon Barkley to be comeback player of the year.
Yeah, that was something else. Anyways, thank you for coming on, Will. Any final thoughts before I get you out of here?
Final thoughts. Well, trivia question. Who's the last Giants coach to beat the Chargers as a franchise?
Tom Coughlin did not, because I remember Eli Manning never beat the Chargers in his career. Jim Fossil.
That's the correct answer. Yeah, that's a correct answer. It's been over. I think it's been 20 years now since the Giants beat the Chargers.
Because I know Eli never beat the Chargers.
I think it was the year before the Texans joined the NFL that the Giants last beat the Chargers.
Yes. Eli was close that one year in 09 at home.
That the Vincent Jackson game, touchdown. That game. You want to talk about a coach being too conservative. After Terrell Thomas got that interception, Tom Coughlin playing for the three still bothers me. And I still talk to Terrell Thomas about that anytime I see him on the timeline.
Yeah, that 2009 was a really rough year, because there was a lot of games like that Charger game. But anyways, we'll enjoy it. We'll talk again hopefully soon. And the end of the season is getting close, my man.
I guess
I see you got a lot of white hair now. The Giants have really done a number on you.
Yeah, it's funny how that works. It's not even snow either. So my question for you, what do you want the Giants to do as of right now with Joe Judge?
I think you have to clean house. I think you have to clean house because you brought up a good point that I didn't even recognize, because you're going to need an overhaul on your coaching staff, and I don't think you're going to get the best hires in terms of assistants, in terms of coordinators, with a lame duck head coach. But I'll say this, right? If they hold a real GM search and they make the proper moves and they don't pigeonhole themselves to Joe Judge and they leave that decision to whoever's running the front office, I'm fine with it. The one thing I really, really hope at this point what they do not do is that they do not say who we hire as the GM has to align with Joe Judge. I think you can have, you know, philosophical similarities, but it cannot be, if I'm hiring you, you're keeping this guy.
I completely agree with that. And I think, you know, that's where this argument, I think, is most interesting to me, because a lot of people are using the same argument I made in 2019 as to why Joe Judge needs to be dismissed, which is you want your head coach.
Pat Shermer.
I'm saying their argument about why Judge needs to be dismissed is my argument about that is an argument that I made in 2019, which is you want these guys on the same schedule, on the same calendar. You want everybody in sync. And my argument in 2019 was essentially, if you're not firing Gettleman, you're not accepting the full magnitude of his mistakes, and you're giving Joe Judge, you're setting him up to fail, essentially. And I don't think that it's, you know, I think the personnel decisions that are crippling this roster are the personnel decisions from before Joe Judge was hired, as you've heard me say. And so I think, you know, I don't want him to be fired for mistakes that he wasn't the one who made. And because I think that the damage that does to the pool of candidates is very similar to, you know, interviewing people if he's, you know, 1 foot in and 1 foot out. Because, you know, you heard John Mara when Joe Judge was hired saying, I learned I need to be a little bit more patient with the head coach this time around. And if that's happened basically three times in a row now where you're like, no, this guy, we made such an improvement with this guy. We're not going to make that mistake again. And then after two losing years, you're like, oh, okay, well, sorry. It hurts. And I go back to 2020. The Giants did not interview all the candidates that they wanted to. And I think that there's an organizational lack of appeal that was a part of that. And I mentioned, we talked about Ron Rivera for a lot of this podcast. The Giants wanted Ron Rivera. And that was originally in their plans when they were getting rid of Shurmur. But the football team, the Redskins then, had already moved on from Jay Gruden and were positioned to pounce on him right away.
You're right. I think you can't... I want to be patient. And a lot of it's because I don't really like a lot of the crop of coordinators that are... Like, there's no coordinator that pops out to me right now. Like, that's the guy I want if we fire Joe Judge. Like, I'm not high on Brian Daboll, who might get fired as the Bills offensive coordinator. I'm not high on Bieniemy.
Wink?
There's no college coach.
Do you like Wink?
I do like Don Wink Martindale, yeah. I do. But my brother, who's a big Ravens fan, keeps telling me, look, some guys are made to be coordinators, some guys are made to be head coaches, and he thinks Wink Martindale is made to be a...
Yeah, I loved what a point that you and Ethan had made earlier this year, because we were talking about Jason Garrett, and a lot of people were saying, like, maybe they'd be better if doesn't have to be a head coach and he can be an offensive coordinator. And you were like, wait a second, I think this guy is better as a head coach than as an offensive coordinator.
Oh, he is.
Because he's...
I think he's 100%.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. So... and one thing that a lot of people have said to me in criticizing my inclination to want to stick with Judge is that my expectations for this guy are way too low. And I agree with them. I had no expectations for Judge and win-loss. And I basically said I couldn't even talk about win-loss until Gettleman's out. And maybe that is a hyperbolic, like the bar being too low. But I've seen so much directional improvement that I'm willing to, you know, ride this out a little longer.
To me, it's the I'm with you. You know, I said it on the spaces. I agree with a lot of his, you know, his philosophies, and I see what his direction in terms of roster building. But man, when you watch him coach, man, you can't be that lost. I wanna listen. I'm trying my hardest to buy in on Joe Judge, but then a Sunday comes around. And I see some of his decisions. And we didn't even talk about the timeouts. We didn't talk about the fact that he was so tone deaf in his post-game press conference. Like, those stuff don't... The press conferences don't matter unless you make them matter. And you make them matter when you say things like what he said after the game.
So I thought that Evan Engram had a very good game, and I thought that he was a positive, and I thought Andrew Thomas was a positive. So if you're actually looking for positives, you can find them even on offense. I will personally say that I was much more upset by Joe Judge saying that Saquon Barkley is a huge part of this team and that, you know, they still have a huge role for him than anything he said after this past game, which is what he said in 2020 when Barkley was hurt, and what he said when he's talked about Barkley, because I think Joe Judge will always have his players' backs, and sometimes, you know, you can't even take it seriously, but
that's fine.
But I'm not as concerned with what he said, because I don't really, you know, and we didn't even really talk about the Pert Soldier situation, because I know that's been kind of beaten to death over the last 2 weeks, but I don't think he needs to give fans the answers. I think he needs to give the locker room the answers there, and
we're not asking. Here's the thing though, Will, I'm not asking him for come out there and to start saying this guy didn't play well, that guy didn't play well. Basically, do what he did.
Yeah, Riley Dixon sucks.
What he basically told the world
about Jason Garrett. Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah, I'm not asking that. But like I said, the press conferences don't matter to me unless you make them matter, and you make them matter by being tone deaf. My man, you scored 9 points. You scored 2 offensive touchdowns in 3 weeks. I'm not asking you to come in here and, you know, and if you want to eliminate the everything post Garrett, you've scored 22 points in 2 games, 1 offensive touchdowns in 8 quarters. I need you to come out there and say, if you would have come out and said this is a collective issue, the players are not executing, coach is not doing a good job, we're not living up to our standard, I would have been fine with it. That's fine. But when you come out there and you make it seem like everything is great, which you did, to me it's just tone deaf. You're insulting the fan base's intelligence. I don't agree with that. I would have much more him say, hey, look, we're not executing properly. We're not doing a good job from a personnel standpoint. Coaches are not doing a good job right now. And the results are showing we got to get better. Case closed. That's it.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree. I'm not going to disagree with that, but.
Like, there's a right way to do it and there's a wrong way. And it seems like he took the wrong approach.
You know, I think we actually have to spend a few more minutes here because there's something else we have to talk about.
Go ahead. I got all the time in the world.
Okay, I don't have that much more time, but if Mike Glennon got a concussion during the game and then was finally diagnosed with that concussion after the game and he was playing half concussed, like, this training staff is a disaster. And, you know, I was going to say, like, if Mike Glennon is, like, hurt, is banged up and is still able to get through the game without turning the ball over, that's, like, a positive. And, you know, we don't necessarily know about that. But it seems like it's week after week with just not even knowing how hurt guys are, not knowing their schedules for getting back.
Do you remember Ronnie Barnes had a really bad rap with the fan base from, like, 2010 to like 2000.
Yeah, oh, I remember. Yeah, with when 15, everybody was getting,
there was like a 5-year stretch
that felt like everyone was getting hurt. I don't know. It wasn't, you know, just Ronnie Barnes specifically, but it was just in general. It was like, are the Giants cursed? And I personally at the time was like, wow, Coughlin clearly practices these guys so hard.
I think with Ronnie Barnes, somebody told me that Ronnie Barnes is a very important piece of that organization in terms of how loyal John Mara is to him.
Yeah, I think that's true. But, you know,
he's basically a Mara. He's basically a member of the family.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we talk about the wholesale changes. Like the phrase like LPG always uses is these lifers within the organization. I think, you know, the fact that we are in the medical capital of the world and we can't get a training staff who understands the severity of people's injuries, it's mind-numbing. And I think that is as alarming as anything going on right now. I mean, you saw Tony, you saw Thomas, aggravating injuries multiple times, you know, not understanding the timelines for guys being on IR and not taking advantage and putting guys on IR.
To me, it's the disconnect between the coaching staff and the training staff. Like, how does Daniel Jones go from practicing and probably being available to then ruled out after seeing a neck? Like, it seems like either the medical staff is slow to diagnose these things or they're not being transparent enough with the coaching staff. Like, Joe Judge can't force anybody to practice. That, I'm not blaming him for the injuries. But there just seems to be, like, a disconnect between the two staffs. Like, I don't understand how are these things are getting diagnosed, because it seems like there was another injury too where we didn't hear, like, in the beginning of the week everyone is like, okay, he's gonna play. I can't remember who it was, but then by like Wednesday or Thursday it was like, oh no, ruled out. You know, like, something is going on there.
It reminds me of 2015 when Victor Cruz was hurt in camp with like the weird stuff with his calves, and he was like 3 weeks away from playing all year. Art Stapleton tweeted today that the Giants are optimistic that Joe Judge will return, and I quote tweeted it with three screenshots of the Giants showing optimism with Victor Cruz coming out, and then his career log that showed he never played in 2015, but. Their medical diagnoses are based on hope.
Yeah, which a lot of things are with this organization. A lot of it's hope. I think, listen, Ronnie Barnes has been with the Giants since, I think, the 80s. I think he was hired by Wellington Mara. So there's a better chance of a lot of things happening before Ronnie Barnes gets the can.
Yeah, and I think this goes so deep, and it's not about the draft pick. It's about John Mara deciding that getting it right is more important than the comfort of stability.
I'm with you. On that note, Will, you promised to come on. when the Giants hopefully make the changes they got to make. Because we're going to have a virtual party. Cigars. I don't drink, but you got your booze.
Pretzels, donuts. Regular
stuff. Pretzels, donuts, yeah. We can do all that. So we got about a month. Tomorrow will be 1 month. Tomorrow we will be 1 month away from the final game of the regular season.
Wow, so it's 33 days until Dave Gettleman is officially out of the general manager role.
33, 34, yeah.
No, it's called Black Monday for a reason.
Right.
Well, Weiss, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, to everyone who's been listening, sorry if any of the technical difficulties, slowed us down at all. But,
Oh, we got a great editor. He'll fix it.
Love to hear that. Love to hear that. Go Giants.
Thank you very much.
Better days are ahead.
And I hope so. I hope better days are ahead. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. Thanks again, man. And thank you all for listening.
All right. Take care.
Peace.